any coughing fits or anything. Please forgive me if I have a little cough. In 1511, Isabella d'Este, who was the Marchesa of Mantua in northern Italy, was inconsolable over the death of her favourite lapdog, Aura. Aura, we are told, accompanied Isabella in her daily life, lived in her private rooms, and affectionately chewed on the Marchesa's fingers. This paper is about dogs like Aura and some cats, for good measure. Anyone here doesn't like dogs, I doubt. These were animals who lived pampered lives in close contact with the ruling family. They were bred for soft, luxuriant fur, bred to be held, stroked, and occasionally, indulgently, nibble a finger or two. This paper represents an early stage in my research on affective and haptic bonds between people and animals in late medieval and early modern Europe. And it looks at the relationship with companion animals and focuses in on that hand in the fur, considering the aesthetic, tactile, and affective importance of proximity and stroking of an animal, and what this means for the animal itself. We'll consider some examples of animals owned in the late 15th and early 16th centuries by several generations of the Gonzaga family who ruled Mantua in northern Italy. Mantua, the territory, is this little yellow one here. We'll look at the Marchese Ludovico Gonzaga, his grandson Francesco's wife Isabella d'Este, and their heir Federico Gonzaga, who would turn out to be Mantua's first duke in 1530. The court of Mantua was highly associated with dogs. The Gonzaga had several dog-related devices that were well known, and they were also renowned for their love of dogs big and small. And a fantastic article of 1978 gave the name Rubino to this fierce, you can't tell, he's fierce here, point, but large hunting dog under the chair of Ludovico Gonzaga in Mantegna's Camera degli Sposi. And the article by Rodolfo Signorini made clear the affective bond between Ludovico and his pet, demonstrated Ludovico's desperation to find Rubino when he went missing, and his response to Rubino's final illness and eventual death. Rubino was apparently unpredictable and very fierce and needed to be chained when he wasn't in the presence of Ludovico. And there's obviously a very clear correlation between rulers and large, powerful animals. The message isn't very subtle. The ability of the prince to tame fearsome creatures. Francis I, King of France, for instance, is said to have had a lion who slept in his bed, as his subjects would have a dog. So, of course, powerful people keep certain kinds of animals. It demonstrates their might, their wealth, their control over people, over subjects, over dominions. They can be high-profile gifts, and they can beautify a court. But there's also something more, an attachment. I quote James Serple, "Throughout history, the world's ruling classes have almost invariably demonstrated a powerful affinity for pets." And it's this word, affinity, that's interesting to me. As with Francis and his lion, or Rubino under the chair, these animals are physically close to the ruler, and also this idea that they're aligned in a kind of understanding. This beast gets me, accords me my rightful respect. And there's also often a sense that people can't be trusted in the same way. So the Duchess of Windsor in 1737, to give another early modern example, writes to her daughters, "I'm very fond of my three dogs. They have all of them gratitude, wit, and good sense, things very rare to be found in this country." So there's often more to the relationship then between the prince and his animals than this obvious manifestation of power. Another Italian Renaissance example is when Gian Galeazzo Sforza, the Duke of Milan, is dying. He asks for his horses and hounds to be brought around his deathbed so that he can say goodbye to them and have this last moment with them. But interesting things about affective bonds can also be revealed by examining the relationship between rulers and small companion animals, such as lapdogs, animals whose primary role is pleasing companionship. In addition to considering the emotional connections between the Gonzaga and their lapdogs, another thing I'd like this paper to do is to add some more nuance to the gendered view that big dogs are only for male owners and little dogs are just for ladies or children who are big dog owners in training. As well as his big dogs, Ludovico Gonzaga, for example, was very fond of smaller dogs, including a favourite toy spaniel called Bellina. And this slide just gives you an example of what these toy spaniels look like in two examples by Titian. This one I love because she's got a little pretzel. We know what that dog would really be doing, having a little bite. Ludovico Gonzaga's Bellina died while whelping, and she was immortalized for her sweetness in her epitaph. Tombs were erected to other Gonzaga dogs too, including those belonging to Isabella d'Este, who married into the Gonzaga family, coming from Ferrara as the bride of Ludovico's grandson, Francesco II Gonzaga. Isabella is now known as a shrewd stateswoman, a kind of Machiavelli in skirts, and above all as a patroness of music and art. But Isabella is also a renowned collector of animals. These include the famous Gonzaga horses, civet cats bred for their musk, and parrots. And she takes a personal interest in dogs, big and also small. She oversees their breeding and their acquisition, their training, their naming in a very hands-on fashion. Her most famous dog is, of course, the unfortunate Aura, who we met at the start. And Aura may have been not a toy spaniel like these, but a lapdog of the Melitian type, what we would now class as Bichon. Also soft, like the toy spaniel, these have white fur, normally longer if of the Maltese type, as here, shorter if of the Bolognese, as we'll see later on. And everybody laughs at this. And it's because everybody says to me, his face is so human. And that's obviously part of the point of the breeding of these animals that I want to dig deeper into. But let's linger for a moment on the fur, just as that hand is doing. Fur is a commodity, a luxury item, removed from animals, of course, but there's also a significance here in the living fur and the beauty ideal for certain types of small companion animals, which have a variety of sensory dimensions. So we have attributes of smell, for example, and I'm sure that I'm going to find, I haven't yet, but I'm sure I'm going to find evidence of perfuming these dogs. Sound, too, a pleasing yap, such as the cacophony of barks, which according to the writer Bandello proclaim the presence of Isabella d'Este when she's moving along corridors. Attributes of lustrousness and shine, whiteness or other colours or breed markings. And of course, attributes of smallness, cuteness, these kind of human-like infantile characteristics, which increase the ability for empathy. Such characteristics are often reflected in the dog's names, which is another area which I'm looking into, and these frequently include a diminutive suffix. So we have Bellina, beautiful little one, Perlina, little pearl, who is a Medici dog, or the names of two German dogs of the time, Satin and Damask. So these latter two names also indicate the silky feel of the fur. Characteristics related to touch and tactility are important. Here, in showing the animal being touched, the artist is challenged to depict fur that begs to be felt and to invite the viewer to imaginatively share the sensation of luxurious touching. The depiction of stroking in portraits like this indicates possession by the owner and also an emotional connection between the owner and the animal in the act of stroking and being stroked. And the examples that I have on the slides show this reciprocal act of stroking, touching. This image used to be identified as Isabella d'Este, possibly with Aura, but it's not sure that it's Isabella, and it's definitely too early to show Aura. But Aura is just this kind of Maltese, I think, and tributes tell how she was caressed in this way. So proximity and touching are clearly important in the companionate relationship with these small animals. Evidence shows them even inside their owner's clothing. So a famous example, Mary Queen of Scots, for instance, has an entourage of lapdogs that are dressed in blue velvet in the winter time, as she, of course, would. And when she's executed, she has a dog hiding unnoticed under her clothes, very famously. People have said to me, well, that can't be right, that's just a story. But consider, just in these lovely examples, the dinky size of these dogs and the big size of some of these clothes. easily hidden away. Before I alluded to a kind of lack of obvious utility of lap dogs beyond companionship, but it should be added that in medieval and early modern Europe, two arguments are sometimes put forward for uses of lap dogs and other small pets. These are both related to them being close to human bodies. The first is to help people by keeping them warm and keeping their feet cozy in bed, kind of living hot water bottle argument. And the second is to attract parasites away from human flesh. So Juliana Barnes in the 1486 Book of St. Albans mentions small ladies' puppies that bear away the fleas. The flea-catching argument needs to be pursued further, I think. I'd like to find any evidence for this use in Renaissance Italy. Besides fleas, though, as you know, modern studies suggest that proximity to animals is therapeutic in other ways. For example, increasing self-esteem, alleviating stress, releasing dopamine and endorphins, and lowering blood pressure, for instance. According to breeders, dogs of the Bichon group, particularly the Bolognese that we'll see in a moment, are often trained today as working therapy dogs to assist human practitioners. The dog's temperament and breed history appear to make them excellent at soothing humans and helping their psychological state. But, of course, it's not just the presence of dogs that modern scientific research finds to be beneficial to human well-being, but particularly the act of touching them and of stroking them. But here is an important methodological consideration that I'm really hoping to hear your thoughts on. To what extent can scientific studies in the present be usefully referred to the past? And this is what I keep coming back to as I'm trying to write on this. And I recall John Law's words yesterday, that the findings of science deserve respect, but we cannot take them as revealed truths. That's one thing. But if we're convinced by recent scientific evidence, for example, that the canine brain and human brain share similarities that help us to understand each other, as in a recent study, or that companionate bonds between humans and animals are beneficial to human health, or that stroking animals brings therapeutic benefits to participants in a US or UK study now, what can we do with this in a historical context? Does a finding now indicate the same psychological or physiological response 500 years ago in Italy? And does historical evidence of people stroking or touching animals show an intuitive understanding of increased well-being through affiliative bonding with these animals? Does it show an affective attachment? Does it show a pleasure in physical contact, an aesthetic sensation, or something like wanting warm feet? Or all of these things together in a melting pot? So I've been trying to bring together evidence of breeding luxury animals specifically for softness and strokeability, and then responses to these qualities to see what I can do with those. For instance, the Bolognese naturalist Aldo Vandi gives advice precisely on how to breed smaller, cuter dogs with long, soft coats. This is another image that used to be identified as Isabelle d'Este. The suggestion is made, and I love this, in the Burlington magazine in 1929 that the dog is either Aura or her successor, but it makes the observation that if it's commonly difficult to estimate the age of a woman from a portrait, certainly far more difficult to judge that of a dog. I think we all would agree. Again, whether this is Isabella and Aura or not, we see here the same attention to the proximity of the dog to his or her owner. The act of stroking, here interestingly the hair is curled around a gloved finger, and the juxtaposition of living fur with dead with this marten pelt here. But let's return to Aura and her untimely death, unfortunately. In 1511, Isabella was readying her entourage to depart from a visit, and Aura was racing around, apparently fighting with another dog called Menya, over the affections of a third dog who they both liked very much, and she lost her footing and fell over 10 meters from a small terrace, where obviously she died straight away. What's interesting is Isabella's response to her grief for Aura. She's seen very conspicuously crying around the court, crying over dinner, crying in public. Isabella was very keen to maintain her composure with significant human losses in her life. She didn't cry in public when her mother died, when her children died, but she allows herself to put aside the equanimity that she aspires to mourn quote, the most beautiful and pleasing little dog there ever was. There's something there that I want to figure out. Why is that okay for her? Famously, Aura's death provokes a competitive flurry of literary tributes in Latin and in the vernacular by poets across Italy. And we see this pattern in the Gonzaga response to the death of their favourite companion animals with elegies, epitaphs, funeral rituals. Obviously, these follow classical precedents. Some of them are humanist exercises, but I don't agree with the many scholars who over the years have written off any genuine emotional component to many of these. Isabella's grief also extends to cats. This isn't Isabella, but it's a cat, so it's a nice example. In 1510, Aura and other dogs attended the funeral of Isabella's cat, Martino. And cats again were prized for smallness, a good nature that fosters touching, and a luxuriant soft coat. Like lap dogs, the Gonzaga bred cats, and they also acquired them as gifts. And the year after Aura's death in 1512, Isabella obtained a particularly fine pet cat from India. This was a gift from her 12-year-old heir, who was then in Rome, and Federico Gonzaga describes the kitten he'd managed to get as the most beautiful, most delicate little cat that had ever come from Calcutta. It was said that no such animal had ever been seen in Italy before, and the cat is described as rosso, as red. And I'm still trying to work out whether he's a rare Eastern domestic cat or a tamed wild cat. Whatever he is, this small, delicate, and marvelous animalino, as he's called, little animal, was recognized by Federico Gonzaga as the ideal gift for his mother, whose reputation for singularity was based on the possession of marvels such as this. Isabella's really excited in her letters about this cat arriving. Federico sends the animalino with two other cats, a little black male and a little black female, who are more normal somehow or other. And of the three, the little black male dies on the journey. Isabella was really, really excited when the animalino arrives as well. She carried him in her sleeve all day, and she shows him with pride to her husband, Francesco Gonzaga, who's attending celebrations at the Duomo in Mantua. And the crowds there at the cathedral marvel at the animalino when the prince carries him and say that the animalino has damask-like qualities in the prince's arms. This is a cat to be carried and admired. Isabella ensured that the animalino rested in comfort, had a special bed made, he ate things he liked, apparently, and she never ceased to kiss him and praise him with tender words in the motherese we saw yesterday too. According to one courtier, Isabella's love for Aura was nothing to this. Dangerous words to say, they're not true. Blessed was anyone allowed near enough to touch the animalino. Clearly the prerogative of the ruling couple. Proximity and stroking are central to Isabella's relationship with this new tiny companion animal, and unfortunately, he dies not long after being in Mantua. So this is an interesting case. On the one hand, the animalino is a commodity. He's been traded, gifted, transported across the world. He's valued for certain qualities that are the same as other luxury goods: rarity, delicacy, aesthetic charms of beauty and touch. On the other hand, he's a living, adored creature who's pampered, cradled, babied. We need to ask at this point, as we try to understand the human emotions and implications for human well-being in this relationship, what about the animals? Is the keeping of these companion animals enmeshed in the creation, support, and projection of human identity in ways that are negative to the animal involved? And are these animals, to quote Donna Haraway, affectional slaves? Or can pet keeping bring significant emotional bonds that are good for both human and animal? As we were thinking about yesterday with other animals, how can we assess whether Rubino, Bellina, or Aura were contented dogs? We know they're attached to their owners, they live close to them, they're well cared for, but beyond that, what? And the animalino is even harder. This is an animal whose species isn't certain, whose care isn't able to maintain his health. Did he like to live in a sleeve? When we study the human past and the animal past, we've got to take these feelings into account, but we know it's not an easy thing to do. A last example of affective and tactile bonds, I want to move back to dogs that belong to Federico Gonzaga in his adulthood. One of his dogs is commemorated in this stucco tomb, possibly by Giulio Romano. And we also don't know the name of the dog that Titian portrays in his portrait of Federico, 1529. This might be Viola, his favourite, or one of her offsprings or a successor. Now, it's been suggested that the dog in this portrait plays a purely symbolic role, representing Federico's commitment to conjugal fidelity as a prospective husband. But there's more going on here, I think. This is the touch of an actual dog. Federico's hand sinks into the dog's fur and she returns his touch. What is Federico doing portraying himself with a little dog like this? Here's another male ruler's ownership of and affection for these dogs isn't unusual. There's something of a backlash against excessive fondness of ladies or men for little dogs. For instance, Henry III of France famously is criticised. But Federico, like his great-grandfather Ludovico, attracts no censure for his love of little dogs. His relationship with this dog is played out with elegance. It shows an easy courtliness. To conclude then, I'd like to stress that this is a real dog, whose aesthetic qualities matter in her softness, her tactile appeal. Taking a step forward from an animal depicted in an image or glimpsed in documents or commemorated in stone, it's important for my research to incorporate the materiality of live animal bodies and to consider the effect of movement and senses. This is also a portrait of a dog who is cared for and clearly cares in return for her owner, in interacting in meaningful ways with a person in the past. To very end, a couple more words. I'd like to show you my favourite new painting, or new favourite painting, it's not new, new to me. A jumping off point for more work. Like the portrait of Federico Gonzaga, this is an image of loyalty, of reciprocal trust, affection and understanding. To again quote Donna Haraway following Levi Strauss, dogs are not just to think with, they're here to live with. What did it mean to share life and space with different kinds of creatures, including companion animals? Dogs who smell, bark, yip, run, growl, nip, curl up, eat, lick, play, touch and be touched. How can we access this body language in the past? What's the effect of human and animal feelings? What does it mean to feel an emotional connection with an animal across species boundaries in the past and now? Mm-hmm.